Welcome to the Creative South Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Frostlund. Today, I'm talking with Rochester, Minnesota-based illustrator Amaryllis Henderson. We chat about how she chose watercolor as her medium while she was still in high school, teaching and building classes on Skillshare, the process of licensing your illustration work, how she uses painting to process things like her faith and emotions, and more, all right after this. Jack Prince is one of our favorite companies to work with. They offer great products at even better prices, with some of the best customer service I've ever seen. Why not pick Jack Prince next time you need t-shirts, business cards, stickers, or flyers printed? Right now, Jack Prince is offering 4-day turnaround on their most popular apparel products. That's 4 days with no rush fees, no hassle, and no BS. With apparel from popular brands like American Apparel, Next Level, Gildan, All Style, and more, starting as low as $3.99 each. Now is the time to take advantage of this great offer. Visit jack.inc/4days to order your apparel today. Plus, Jack Prince is giving Creative South Podcast listeners 20% off all orders over $25 when you use promo code CREATESOUTH17 at checkout. Visit jackprince.com for your next order of stickers, prints, or whatever you need today. We've gone through and streamlined the Creative South Podcast Patreon page, cleaning out the excess and making it easier for you to support us. With options starting at just $1 per month, you can help support the podcast and even wind up with some cool Creative South Podcast swag. Every dollar helps cover hosting costs, upgrade equipment, and keep the podcast going. When you become a Creative South patron, you'll get access to exciting Creative South news before anyone else, Creative South Podcast stickers and t-shirts. So, please help support the podcast and become a patron over at patreon.com/creativesouth. Amaryllis, thank you for joining me this evening.
I'm excited to be here.
So I always like to start off with, where did you grow up? And we talked about this a little bit real quick off air, but...
Yeah, well, it's kind of complicated, but I started in Puerto Rico, and okay. My family's Puerto Rican. When my parents divorced, when I was pretty young, my mom brought me to the States. And so From there, actually, we moved around quite a bit. So when people ask me where I'm from, I usually give them a list. Like Puerto Rico, Alexandria, Virginia, Maryland, Atlanta, Chicago, Dallas, and then I went to school in Savannah, Georgia.
Okay. So aside from the Puerto Rico part, I definitely understand that because I moved around a lot as a kid. That's why when you asked me where I was from, I was like, well, I grew up in Minnesota, but so I'm originally from Chicago area and then moved to Minnesota, Florida, Kentucky, Georgia. Here in Alabama, Georgia again, back to Alabama. So I've bounced around quite a bit as well. So I definitely understand that.
You have a couple in common there.
Yeah, yeah. I've lived a couple places in Georgia. I actually lived in St. Simon's Island for about a year, which is just south of Savannah.
Must be pretty small.
It's very small. It's, you know where Brunswick is? So 15 minutes off coast from Brunswick. Okay. It's right above Jekyll Island.
Okay.
Like, you take that road out to Jekyll Island, you turn left to go to St. Simon's, you turn right to go to Jekyll Island.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
I've got to go visit again.
Yeah. I haven't been in, I don't know that I've been since my kids were born. Maybe once. So when you were growing up, were you always kind of the artsy kid or?
Yeah, I was that just painfully shy girl that had, always a sketchbook or a coloring book and actually a whole backpack of, my mom would just give me something to carry pretty much everywhere. And she went to art school when I was 5 or so. She went back to school to study design. And so she would have her projects and I would have my projects, and that just really solidified art for me.
And gotcha.
I guess I was raised always seeing it as a feasible career. Maybe not. It was never oversold to me.
Not necessarily the most lucrative career.
Right. Yeah. Right. It was just like, yeah, you could do that. You ready? Ready for that? Okay. Yeah. All right, cool. You can do that. So
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So if your mom went to school for design, some of this stuff was obviously you were around it from an early age and, mm-hmm. you know, grew up with it. So that had to, when you got into things, mm-hmm. you know, once you got to college and all that, must have made things a little bit easier. Or yeah. it could have made things a little tougher. She could have been a critic.
No, she really had no idea. I guess she just thought, you know, kids draw, that's their sure. thing. Until there was an open house at school. I can't remember which grade. It must have been early on. But the teachers were praising my drawings. And she was like, yeah, they're good, you know. Mm-hmm. And then she saw, in comparison with the rest, how my, I don't know, people had noses and clothes on and, you know, details. And then she kind of caught on to, oh, this is something that we should really cultivate. So gotcha. I do credit her a lot for doing that.
Okay. Yeah. So when you got to high school and all that, were you taking every art class available at that time, or were you?
Yes. This is getting really boring, isn't it? It's just like,
No.
I did like regular art class and I did AP art class and it's
wow, you had AP art class. I'm impressed.
Yeah, but I did not score the highest score. So I was kind of disappointed about that. But it was a weird concentration. We had to choose something that was a focus and create a portfolio and we did slides and it felt very professional. But what I chose was self-portraits of me peeking behind things in watercolor.
Okay.
So that's where I started to paint watercolor. I basically just tried to stack challenges against each other. And I find that I'm still doing that. I do that a lot on Instagram. I'll say, you know what? I'm going to do 100 of these or 50 of that. And I'm just going to do this even though I've never painted a bird before and I've just painted 50. So. Sure. I'm noticing a pattern there.
Sure. What is it that drives you to want to do these, you know, I don't know, extended runs of projects and things? What's the challenge behind them?
Yeah, it's the chase. It's the challenge. I think someone was talking, we were talking about trend and mm-hmm. I said, you know, you either love it or you hate it, but when I see trends, it's not like I'm thinking, oh no, now I've got to do a million pineapples or I'm going to do a pineapple and copy this guy who did a pineapple. It's more like, I wonder what that would look like coming out of my hand. I wonder sure. how I'd do that. And so I think part of being creative is just being curious and mm-hmm. and exploring how things work. And maybe that's why I choose these challenges to put on myself.
Sure. Where do you find the discipline to stick with it? Because I am one mm-hmm. of those people. I have tried so many 30-day projects, mm-hmm. and I get to about day six, and I'm just like, mm-hmm. something comes up, and I've got to, you know, push that off. And mm-hmm. I'm the typical, well, I'll get to it the next day, and mm-hmm. then the next day. And then by the end of it, it's the end of the month. I'm like, oh, screw it. I'm not going back to that.
Forget it. Yeah. The accountability of social media definitely helps.
Gotcha.
So having to put, this is number 6 of 100, mm-hmm. you know, it's not just something that I don't know, you can just step back from and be like, well, I did 6 of them. You know, mm-hmm. it's like, well, I got to do something. But I do sometimes turn a corner. If I, you know, with this last 100-day challenge, I wanted to explore colors.
Sure.
And so I thought, well, wouldn't it be fun to have like us, feed that's all looking like a rainbow almost because every day you're doing a different color.
Mm-hmm.
But that got really boring because I
can see that.
Yeah, I'm not a monochromatic lover. And then the most beautiful pieces had a lot of white space. And so I wasn't getting my rainbow action. And that's when I decided to do the birds because I have a lot of these Dr. P.H. Martin's paints that are in a liquid form. They're concentrated watercolors. Mm-hmm. And I don't use them as often because I don't go through the effort of taking a bottle down and squeezing it into a palette and putting it mm-hmm. back. I go to the palette that's already ready to go.
Sure.
And so then I decided to, okay, what could be something that has a lot of different colors that I could do one of with each one of these? And I have the added incentive that I have kind of my own swatch book. Mm-hmm. So I do flowers a lot. I thought of flowers, but it wasn't challenging me, so I chose birds. Yeah. So I try to stack up the motivation, right? If I don't see it, if I see it sitting in a sketchbook, it's not going to be as motivating to me as something that I can use in my portfolio. So
sure.
Yeah. I have to add incentives for myself too.
See, I think that's what I need, is I need to figure out a way to add incentives. Mm-hmm. Maybe I need to reward myself with beer by the time I finish drawing each one.
You could put a little sticky note after each so many pages in your sketchbook. Time for a beer. Go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I'm definitely that guy. I have a hard time with self-initiated work. I need... Mm-hmm. I need that direction. And that's part of why I got into design, because I need that direction. I need that prompt to come up with something.
I really like direction. I really like parameters, which is probably why I give myself parameters. But I look at, especially, you know, being in illustration, I see all these different avenues you could go down. And we can talk about that later, just different industries. And I want to try it all. And so I need someone to say, okay, look, this is the mood. This is what we're going for. And then I go, okay, got it. I can do that.
Okay.
So I get that.
Gotcha. So backing up a little bit, when you were in high school, and what was it specifically about, and this is tying in watercolor again, what was it specifically about watercolor that interested you?
It came somewhat easily, much more easily than blending with acrylic. And at the time, though, watercolor wasn't very sexy. Watercolor is very popular now, but it was all about the canvas and something, you know, sturdy and like, wow, that's art, you know, and watercolor just didn't have that because it was on paper. But I guess the rebel in me was like, forget it. I'm going to try to make it cool. but it's a lot easier for me than these other paint mediums or even color pencil, where you have to layer and you're just really trying to get things to blend. But I feel that watercolor kind of does it on its own. And if you're okay with letting the paint decide or have a say in how this thing is going to end up, then it's wonderful. But if you're a control freak, maybe not for you.
So I'm a control freak. hence the reason I'm a graphic designer. You know,
there's no delete, no backspace, no command Z, right?
Yeah. I mean, how do you push that control aside? Because when I sit down, I'm like, I sketch something out and then I want to move it on to the next step. I have it very clear in my head what I wanted to do. And I realize after years of practice, you know how the medium's going to work and what's going to.
But
there is still a bit of chaos to it where, you know, that, and like you said, there's no control Z on a paintbrush. How do you reconcile with that?
Well, that used to really bother me until I had my first kid.
So I'll send you in one of two directions.
That'll just, you know, file you down. And I started really, what happened was I had actually worked in design for 3 years before I got back into painting.
Okay.
And so I needed that direction. I needed the, okay, this is what we're going for. And I'm like, oh yeah, okay, I get it. And I liked getting feedback, and I kind of saw myself as a yes man, and I'm okay with that. Mm-hmm. But then when I had my first son, I just kind of needed to go back to my roots or remember who I was instead of just a feeding machine or whatever, nurture.
But like 9 months, that's your job.
Yeah, it's just like eat, sleep, feed. It's all a blur. Yeah. And I would just sit down and just needed to just do something that was just me.
Sure.
And with limited time, I knew watercolor had to be it, just because I couldn't tinker. I couldn't sketch something out and say, okay, this is how I want it to look. It was very emotive. So that's what started it. And once I got into a pattern where, well, that wasn't what I thought it would be, but I'm a lot happier with it than I thought I would be. Mm-hmm. And I got more and more content with that feeling and happy with how things turned out, whether or not it was what I had in my head. It freed up a lot of me, and I enjoy it a lot more, okay. Obviously. Yeah.
So is it just the kind of looseness and that, you know, and I didn't take a lot of watercolor classes, so I'm trying to remember.
I'm really stretching you here.
Yeah, you are, because I hated watercolor. I think watercolor is beautiful, and I'm not just pandering by saying that. I very much admire watercolor. I sucked at it. And I mean, I sucked at painting in general. That's why I started off thinking, oh, I want to do painting as a major. Mm-hmm. And then I very quickly realized that I will never make a living as a painter unless I am painting houses, because I am horrible at this.
Well, if you start with, you know, sometimes I just write, because I also incorporate it into my worship time, and I read the Bible and then I just try to figure something that stuck with me. And I wrote the same word over and over and over again, just layered in watercolor. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, sometimes I wrote it wrong, and it just, when you look at it, it looks like a mesh of swirls, you know, kind of cursive writing all stacked up on each other. Sure. And so going with something that you feel more comfortable with helps. I have a Skillshare class that some people have found helpful that I call Start with a Shape. And that was also a challenge on social media. So I would start with a watercolor circle, whatever color. And I'd fill my sketchbook with these pages of just a blob, basically. And then I'd have to look at the page on that day and figure out what this thing is going to be. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it would be a flamingo, because I'd, you know, take a little head and loop it out of there, stick some legs with backwards knees on them, and it's a flamingo. Or it's a face, or it's a mouse, or it's the sun. That would be super easy. But, you know, ice cream cone. And it really kind of loosens you up to, because it's really a strategic challenge more than anything. So you're just proud that I figured out something that this could become, and you're not as focused on what the finished product looks like.
Sure. Well, let's go back and talk about the Skillshare stuff real quick. Yeah. How did that come about? I've seen kind of two routes of Skillshare classes, where Skillshare either approaches you, or every once in a while they put out a call for teachers to do stuff. So at what round were you in on things?
I think it's only been 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah. Is it really? Anyway, 2 years. And I was looking at different ways to monetize, basically, my play time. And I thought about YouTube, and I saw, okay, you need so many million subscribers, or so many number of subscribers, in order to get advertising, yada, yada. I had a blog at the time, and I looked at a couple of other websites like Skillshare. I liked Skillshare's more professional vibe. Mm-hmm. And I kind of got in at a good time, because I looked for watercolor classes and there were two.
That is good timing.
So you go on there now, I don't know how many hundreds you'll find. Mm-hmm. So that was definitely a big game changer. And there was a contest, which does incentivize me. Uh-huh. And I won the contest, which now, yeah, the prizes are like way better. I got a 1 year free membership, and now it's like, you know, win that and an iPad. I don't know. You know, it's kind of a big difference there, but yeah, it was good. It got me going.
You need to get an iPad out of that, because basically you got $100.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, not that, you know, Skillshare is great. It's free great. Membership's cool, but iPad's even cooler.
Yeah.
Especially, like you said, you have two boys, and you had to do something to entertain them at times.
Dangerous.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So that's how I started on Skillshare.
Gotcha.
And when I won that challenge, I just felt validated, I guess. Like, it was just a stab, and I didn't really think the class was that great, and I hate to watch it now.
Sure.
But it was like, okay, well, maybe there's something to this, and forward I went, and now I think I've got over a dozen classes.
Wow. So what is that process like of building a class? And had you had experience with something like that before?
No. And a good 9 or 10 of them were done with iMovie.
Oh, wow.
So,
I mean, I'm not judging you. I learned how to edit on iMovie. So yeah, it's a perfectly fine tool.
I'm using Final Cut Pro now, but okay. I just learned by doing. I'm probably doing a lot of things wrong, you know, and maybe that person that uses Photoshop, you know, and you look at them and you're like, oh, there are much easier ways to do what you're trying to do. But
sure I'm that way when it comes to editing podcasts and video and all that stuff, too.
So yeah,
I found what works for me.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, honestly, it's not my fave, right? I think that a lot of us, especially if we're teaching on Skillshare, editing's not really our thing. It's just kind of something that we need to do to make it a product. But yeah, it was tough. I don't know. It was tough learning, but I had a professor in college who told me, you know, if someone asks you at an interview, do you know this software? Mm-hmm. You say yes, no matter what. And it's not lying, he said. It's borrowing from the future, because you will go home, you will go to Barnes & Noble and get, you know, whatever book you need, or now it would be whatever online course you need.
Sure.
And you will learn that
whatever's
software
on Skillshare.
Yeah. This is not endorsed by Skillshare.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
So with that process, and, you know, specifically building the curriculum that, you know, goes into it, how did you set out about developing that first course of this is what I want to focus on, since you said it was about shapes, of, you know, figuring out point A to point B, then all the steps in between?
My first class was called Design a Watercolorful Alphabet. And what it is basically writing all the letters by tracing an existing font in watercolor and then turning that into vectors. The reason why I chose that was I was doing it and was excited about it. I think that's mm-hmm. It's a big deal. No matter what you're doing, you need to be excited about it. Another thing is that, you know, when I started to think about watercolor, I don't feel like some sort of watercolor sage. You see my paintings, they're not terribly realistic. You know, you won't see it in a gallery, because it's, you know, a llama with the cutest underbite, but, I needed something.
There's a market for that.
Yeah. Yeah, there is, but it's just not going to be, in that place. But, I had to go for something that I could say, I know how to do this. I know it inside out. Like, I'm not posing myself as Miss Whatever. This is just, you know, for this particular little niche thing, I can do it. And Skillshare provides kind of an outline. It's more of a table that helps you define the flow of the class. Mm-hmm. And there's some good hints there. But I understood that you start, you know, there's an opening. There's what you're going to need. This is what you're going to learn. Steps 1, 2, and 3, and a closing. So then it's a matter of just breaking it down into those segments.
Sure. How do you go about building out the content for each of those segments? Because that terrifies me. Because I've seen some where, you know, you've got your intro and that's like 3 minutes, and then you've got this is what you'll need, and that's like 5 minutes, and then there's one lesson that's like 10 minutes, and then the next one is like 30 minutes. And then
I try not to do that.
Yeah. You know, and, you know, some of them I understand why they're broken up that way of this is something you need to know, but you can focus on that in a different thing. You know, and other parts of it, you know, there needs to be a consistent flow. So how did you build that?
I'm kind of at a growing pain stage. So before I would build it and it was very well outlined, but more and more, my biggest fear is that someone will watch the class and be like, well, that was a waste of time. I already knew how to do that. Like, I didn't gain anything from that class, because I hate that feeling.
Sure. We've all taken a few of those classes.
Yes. And even if you play it in the background, you're like, ah, I could have listened to something useful. So, I found that my process is getting more and more as I go, like, oh, this is like a really useful tip. So it's hard to anticipate those things. And when I say I'm at a growing pain stage, I am starting to outsource some of the video editing, which yay, but it means that you really have to have your act together.
Sure.
So when it comes to organizing the content, I will, for one, while I'm editing, if I'm seeing that a segment is running 20 minutes, then I'll look for the breaking points and chop it off. Because I do try to keep them at about 5 to 10 minutes each. Mm-hmm. And then you always want to throw in an anecdote. It's really great to hear a story, mm-hmm. Especially if it's a time you screwed up. Everybody likes to hear that. And yeah, just to feel like you can relate to the student where they're at, because we've all been there, and I've been there, maybe I was there just a month ago. So it's fresh in my mind. I read the book, Make It Stick, and it actually encourages you to teach. It's not a book about teaching, but it's one of the points was that when you've just learned something, it's a good time to teach it. Sure. Not when you're a professional and a master, actually is how they put it, when you're a master. Because when you're a master, then things do become second nature and you're unable to break it down into steps. Talking about it helps me break it down into steps. So I'll start painting and I'll start talking, and that's not usually the audio that I use, but it helps me go through the steps, articulate them, and understand what I'm going to teach in a class.
Okay. So you walk yourself through the process as you're doing it.
I teach myself first, yeah.
Yeah, and allow yourself to go through tangents, and then you come back and do a voiceover essentially to piece it together. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense. And, you know, since you said it's kind of evolved and you're at the growing pains point, with the editing specifically, so... And this goes back to our previous conversation about control. Uh-huh. How are you finding giving direction and handing that stuff off to somebody else and relinquishing that control on that?
Yeah, I haven't done that much. Given away that much control. I'll basically number my files very well and say, okay, this is the sequence. It's hard because I want them to understand kind of the way I usually do things. I mean, it would be kind of weird to watch, you know, a handful of somebody's classes and then suddenly this is different. I mean, it might be refreshing, but you kind of want to know what to expect. So giving up control, you kind of come to a point where you're like, I just have to. Mm-hmm. I just have to, because editing does take so long, and there are other things that I'm more excited about, and I could, you know, get more jobs this way as I work on my commission work or my licensing gigs.
Sure. So yeah. I definitely understand that. I have not gotten to a point where the podcast makes me enough money where I can source out the editing, but I would love to be able to get there one day, because that is my least favorite part of doing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, with this show, thankfully, there's not a ton of editing that really needs to be done. Mm-hmm. You know, every once in a while, it's more editing out, like if somebody sneezes or if there's a weird glitch with Skype and stuff like that. But
that would not be hard. That would not be hard to hand off.
No. So, but it's that getting the intro and all those, because like by the time I do the intro and I do sponsor stuffs and things like that, that's like 5 separate files. And I'm just so worried about, you know, you piece this and check to see if this first take was better than the second. That's the part that I'm like, I don't know how to do that without just cutting it down and putting it together myself.
Yeah. Yeah. And then with video, you've got layers, right? So you've got the visual and you got the audio, and then you've got like, I try to do like images interspersed.
Sure.
So we've been doing a bit of back and forth via Dropbox. I don't recommend it. So we're now talking about how to do this differently because those files, they take forever to load. And for us to be able to hand it off again, we're talking kind of a week, because it takes a couple days for that to load. And then I work on it, and then a couple more days, and it's
all that raw video has got to be. I mean, you got to, even if you're doing the pro account, you've only got a terabyte of storage. And well, those videos
can
get huge.
I'm okay with that. It's my computer doesn't like it.
Yeah, exactly.
So Dropbox is fine, right?
Yeah, Dropbox can handle it. Your computer may not be. That's mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe me, I understand that, because my wife and I both freelance, and this is probably like the seventh podcast. People are going to get bored of this, but we've recently started collaborating on stuff. Mm-hmm. And so that handing off files between computers and stuff is a frustrating part of the thing. Not for any other reason than by the time it uploads and syncs and her computer is, oh God, probably 10 years old and dying.
Yeah.
And it's like, just need one more good paycheck gig to come in so we can afford a new computer.
Or another Skillshare challenge, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's also, you know, typical life. The minute you get the money saved up to actually get the thing that you need to get, something breaks in the house that needs to be replaced a lot more. Mm-hmm. So
you need to be sensible.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I feel buying a new computer when you have a 10-year-old computer, and that is part of the vast part of your living is mm-hmm. a sensible purchase, but it's also really nice to have a working water heater. So
yeah, it's also a good expense. So
yes, yeah, I can at least write off the computer on taxes. Actually, yep. I can write off the water heater on taxes too. But
oh, right,
it's home improvement.
Yeah.
So So switching gears and getting off the tangent of home improvement.
I'm glad I don't envy you. I don't have to steer this boat. You go ahead and keep us on track.
No, so you mentioned, you know, with the Skillshare classes have led to you getting more work and things like that. How did that come about? What was the logical progression, or was there a logical progression between?
I really didn't expect it. I didn't expect it. I think that a lot of people, many people do it for exposure for clients. I think for design, it makes more sense because what I do is geared towards manufacturers and larger mm-hmm. companies that may or may not be watching Skillshare, right?
Mm-hmm.
So for designers, I've heard other fellow teachers say it's been great because, you know, we've gotten to do branding for these people and these students really work for mm-hmm. this company, and it's worked for them. But I didn't expect those worlds to collide. I just kind of saw it as an outlet for teaching. You know, I'm an introvert, but you put me in front of a computer, I can talk and I can put it on, but put on the show. But when it comes to doing it in person, I wouldn't call myself a teacher.
Sure.
Anyway, so I started doing it as kind of its own thing. It was this thing way over there that I enjoy, and I'm going to swing back into painting work. Mm-hmm. And I'm seeing more and more those two collide. And the way they do collide, for one, I've shared this before on another podcast, but your listeners have not heard it, that I was at Surtex, which is an art licensing conference trade show.
Mm-hmm.
And my little booth, and I see a group of four go by. You see four people, you think, okay, this must be a big company to send four people here. And one of them recognized me from Skillshare. And we start talking, and then they're like, oh, wait a minute, let's look at your stuff. And that turned out to be just such a great connection that I really just did not see mm-hmm. coming. So there's that. And there have been other students that have asked me to do kind of branding type things, or they see my faces class and they think, oh, can you do my face for this branding or this blog mm-hmm. or whatever?
Okay.
I think, you know, when it comes to exposure, which is kind of a four-letter word for most of us.
I like that I'm the only one who can see you doing air quotes here, too.
Well, because there's exposure and then there's exposure, right?
Yeah, there's good exposure, and then there's the, you're going to work for free.
Right. But it's just, not that there's stabs in the dark, but you just kind of cast the net wide and you see what falls. It's just better to not kind of set your heart on that exposure, which is probably what irks us, right? So
sure.
Do this free work for me with the bait of exposure. I don't think I can do much with the expectation being exposure. That's not the end goal. I've got to actually enjoy the work or want to do the work.
Yeah.
And then the exposure will come. So.
So basically, you don't want to do things for other people for free.
No, I'm just putting that out there. I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
I actually do decide, okay, I'm going to do so many free hours or jobs this year.
That's pro bono.
Right. And so I'm very intentional, like, these are people that I want to partner with. Like, I really believe in what they're doing or whatever, mm-hmm. but not, right. It's sad. Yeah. Not the people who actually ask typically. Is that bad?
No, because typically, at least in my experience and in the experience of plenty of people I've talked to and friends and people on the podcast and stuff like that, those people who are asking for stuff for free mm-hmm. either don't value you or have the money to pay, but they're just being cheap and don't want to, which mm-hmm. goes back to the they don't value you.
Mm-hmm.
So,
or maybe they don't value you because they need education, right? They don't really know what they're asking
for. Yeah, I mean, there can be several reasons behind that, but it's mm-hmm. still, you know, this is our jobs. This is, mm-hmm. you know, and I'm sure everyone who's listening to this is like, yeah, you're preaching to the choir. But, you know, this is how we make a living. I can't pay the bills on exposure or a hope that more work could come from this.
Right. You can't pay them next year.
No. No. Yeah. Believe me, I've been trying to forever with my student loans. They still keep coming after me.
Mm.
So, going back, because you mentioned that you ran into this person at Certex, but A, kind of explain to me what Certex is.
Okay,
and then,
sorry.
Yeah, because I have a vague understanding of it, but
yeah. No, it is not the only art licensing show.
Sure.
There are others. And when I say art licensing, it's basically creating artwork that then you create contracts or licenses, permissions for mm-hmm. other larger companies to use on their products. So then they make money.
Mm-hmm.
And you either make a percentage or you make money through an advance where they're betting like, okay, we're going to do really well on this. So we're going to pay you so much or whatever.
Sure.
So that's what our licensing is. And I had always wanted to go to Certex. I was actually just going to visit and walk the show, which is expensive in and of itself. But I thought, well, it's education. It'll be a fun trip. And once you know it, 2 months before the show, I'm like, let's just do it. So I did it. And you see all these illustrators and designers with their work. A lot of pattern design. So a lot of surface patterns that are then used not only on textiles, but let's say party napkins for Hobby Lobby or some shoes for Tom's or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. it's, you start to see it all over the place. A lot of trend, like I said, the pineapples, I think we're moving on to other fruit at this point.
I remember the pineapples. So many bad pineapples. Very rarely saw good pineapples.
So many beautiful ones, right? They're just great. We're over it. So the people who walk through aren't your everyday people. They are people that work at these companies that then are able to license your artwork. And we just call them the licensors.
Sure.
Or the licensees. And if you Google those words, you'll just start to get a better understanding of what that industry is like.
Sure. So for an artist, what is that basically for you? What mm-hmm. is that process like of getting your artwork licensed and how does that work and how do you negotiate that? And
mm-hmm. The negotiating is not fun, but let me start from the beginning.
Sure.
So the creating the art's fun.
Yes.
You do. You do need to have a pretty robust portfolio because basically what you're doing is setting up a shop. You can be getting commission work and mm-hmm. oftentimes companies are like, I know exactly what we want. Can you do this?
Mm-hmm.
But they need to see you do it already in mm-hmm. your own work. So I would say that you do need to have a lot of pieces in your portfolio, and you just need to cover whatever industry you want to cover. So a handful off the top of my head would be stationery, mm-hmm. greeting cards, wrapping paper, textiles, home decor, mm-hmm. to name a few. So you can just gear towards one of those. And you start looking, okay, if I'm going to do fabrics for home decor, you won't be doing those pineapples, right? You will be doing sure. florals and different repeats, abstracts that can repeat on a fabric, things like that. And you create your website. You, I wouldn't go to do the trade show just yet. You start to get, you know, some eyeballs on it. It mm-hmm. is kind of a slow process to get that exposure because mm-hmm. the market is really saturated right now. There are a lot sure. of people that want to do it.
Do you think part of that saturation comes from, you know, companies like Minted and Spoonflower and things absolutely. Like that, where they're crowdsourcing all of their stuff for right. exposure a lot of times because right. it's all contest based?
Yes. Contests. Not so much, but I mean, if it's something that I'm going to do anyway, mm-hmm. and it would be fun for the sake of community and see how other people do the same thing, I'll do a contest, but I rarely do contests. But yeah, I do think that Minted and Spoonflower, I mean, there's a lot of, which is great. There's a lot of customization going on, and I have my Etsy shop and the world.
My wife does too.
Yeah. The world's getting smaller. Everybody's looking over everyone's shoulder. And when you start seeing what's selling, what's working, and you mm-hmm. think, well, I could do that, right? And mm-hmm. it's great because you do want opportunity and you do want competition. If there weren't competition, I would probably be doing not as good of work, right? It's motivating.
Sure.
But it's also hard. And what I have found it comes down to is whether or not we creative types are willing to do the work that we don't like to do. And by work, I don't mean the designs we don't like to do, but
the business side
the
of
business.
Things.
Yes. Sure. A lot of us putter out, you know, at 60, 70%, right? So we've mm-hmm. got the work, we got the portfolio. I'm tired of messing with a website and I'm tired of sending out emails and getting no response.
Sure. Why aren't people coming to me at this point?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's because everyone is super busy. So you have to pester them and say, mm-hmm. hey, I'm here. And one of your hey, I'm here is going to be when they had just gotten out of a meeting that they're talking about how much they need more Christmas designs.
Sure.
So
with stuff like that, specifically like Christmas designs, mm-hmm. you're having to design so far ahead of the season.
Yes.
Like they're thinking about Christmas in June.
Yes, you're right.
And how do you get, if you're going for something like that, how do you get your mindset?
That is the advantage of living in Minnesota, right? We still have snow on the ground in April when.
True.
maybe not always, but the big licensing shows, many of them are in the spring.
Sure.
And there's Atlanta Gift Mart, which is in June. So in the spring is when you'll see a lot of illustrators, designers doing Christmas designs to put out there to have ready. So I'm okay with that. I'm really okay with listening to Christmas music anytime.
oh, you're one of those people.
I am.
My wife is one of those people.
I think in my early 20s. My husband threw me an amaryllismus party for my birthday, which sounds nice. Really sacrilegious right now. But it was so fun. We had, you know, a snowman made out of cheese dip
I was about to say made out of cheese dip
September.
Sounds gross. Cheese, so, I can see. Cheese dip sounds gross.
Yeah, that would be hard. That would be hard. I didn't make
it. Impressive.
It had some fingerprints on it, so I was a little bit like, but it was cute. Super cute. But yeah, we had the tree up in September and people were, you know, we hiked up the AC and we were wearing sweaters. It was fun. So I'm one of those people. Totally. Yes, I do take my breaks though. I'm like, okay, enough Christmas. Let's get back to reality.
I'm passing no judgment. I live with one of those. I've learned to accept it. I was very anti-Christmas music for most of my late 20s, just because in my early 20s I waited tables, and you know, especially during the holiday season, you're in a restaurant. That is all you hear, there is no break from it, and it's all the same dozen. And especially like my senior year of college, I worked at a fine dining restaurant, and for some reason they were really enthralled with disco Christmas music.
Ooh.
No. I mean, it's, I can still hear those songs, and now I'm going to be singing one of them later. But it's just not.
No.
No.
Okay.
It's too much. It wears you down when you're hearing it 5-6 days a week for multiple hours at a time with no break. Mm-hmm. You need a break. You need to rest your ears with something.
And I like 50s music, you know, 60s. I have my record player. And so it's an easy transition, you know, to go from the Rat Pack to that
era of Christmas music.
But yeah, I have not looked up disco Christmas.
It's interesting. It is interesting. there's some decent ones, but there's some really, really bad ones.
Oh, I'm sure.
And I can't believe I'm going to say this, but the Carpenters Christmas album, not all that bad.
Okay.
So somebody's going to judge me on that. I'm probably going to be made fun of by some of my friends.
No.
So
it's Christmas.
Yeah, so getting back to what we were originally talking about, we were talking about the business side of the licensing process and how that works.
Yeah.
And I see you taking a deep breath there, like it's already causing anxiety just to talk about it.
It's not fun to talk about, but it's kind of fun. Yeah, I listen to business podcasts to kind of get into that whole mindset. A lot of them think that I should be a millionaire, so that's kind of intimidating. And then I stopped listening to them.
I tend to not listen to those ones that say, if you do this, you tell everybody that. And how many of them are actually millionaires?
The business aspect, following up with people, I have some apps that help me with that. And that's, you know, you just basically reach out for every system and every help you could possibly get for those types of things. When it comes to invoicing, when it comes to writing contracts, you know, you do not the bare minimum, but you do what you need to do and you just get on out of there and go back to your happy place and create something.
Sure. Well, how does for licensing illustrations and all, how does that work? Do you license for, I mean, I realize there's all sorts of different scenarios and things like that, but are you typically licensing for a set number of runs? Are you doing an in perpetuity thing? And how do you decide on that?
So perpetuity has become one of my bad words too.
Okay.
just because, I don't know. I like having a little control. Back to that.
Sure.
We go by years mostly.
Okay.
And what's kind of fun is that if I license a Christmas tree to a greeting card company, it's still available, still in play for other industries, unless otherwise noted in the contract.
Sure.
So I have to keep pretty close notes. It's a pretty bad faux pas to, you know, double license competition.
Yeah, they tend to the front up on that.
Yeah, that would be a problem. So that takes some writing down, some keeping track of. And I've forgotten your original question. I hope that I answered it. What about the business?
So negotiating the contract of, you know, you typically, you're licensing your work for a year or maybe a couple of years, depending on what the thing is.
It's for what, for how long, where, and then how much is determined by those three factors.
Sure. Well, so how is that ratio determined? I mean, obviously, you know, it's also by client of what they can afford and things like that too. But how do you find a number that's mutually beneficial to everybody?
Mm-hmm. You know, I found it really beneficial for me to be in art licensing groups on Facebook because, you know, everyone is mostly tight-lipped. But, you know, there are some things where, you know, someone is like, okay, so these people are asking for this, or they want it forever, or they want it for this way. And, you know, should I charge for different colorways, or should I charge this much? And then some people are very generous with how much they charge, and you kind of gauge where you might fall or what you feel comfortable with. I did, you know, recently get proposed a great regular gig where they wanted something like 100 or 100 designs a year. But they were going for kind of a bulk rate that I wasn't really willing to do. So I did my numbers with those factors in mind. So it's almost like each one of those factors holds a different amount of weight. And I set it up in Excel. Actually, not me. I got help to do this because I hate Excel. to help me find those equations. And it's been really helpful. It's kind of like more of like a rating system. Mm-hmm. And I'll think, oh, okay, well, that's a 10. So that 10s are usually about this much. Or, oh, well, if it's just for Germany for 1 year, then it's much lower.
Sure.
So, but yeah, hearing what other people do, it's huge. And you find that there are circles, tribes, if you want to call them, niches within industries where you, I'm sure you do it as a designer too. And and you share notes. You don't, you know, compare everything, but you kind of, you get your feet wet and you know enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to go back and ask you a couple questions because we never really talked about it, but you know, I know you're big into watercolor and all that, but specifically what type of illustrations do you have, a specific focus that you like to work with client work versus, you know, the licensing work? And
I really like licensing because you're going with what you're excited about.
Sure.
Whether it be after a scroll through Dribbble or whatever, and you're just like, oh, I want to do some blue pumpkins. That's like a thing this year. Mm-hmm. I know you've never thought that, but I have. And then I go back and I do it. And then I just, you know, it's better to create a collection. So you then, you're like, oh, I'll use these same colors and create some things that might go with it, especially if you're wanting to market it to, say, a home decor line. Then they're going to want those isolated elements to put on cups versus the plate that has the full art.
Sure.
And so I find that to be fun. The commissions I've gotten lately have been from a book and a calendar that'll be out in 2019. So it's so hard because when you
hoping you forecast that trend pretty well, I guess.
I know. I don't know how they do it. When you finish a piece, you're just so excited about it, but it's so hard. You gotta, you know, let me keep
wait
this one in my pocket
to see
for 2 years.
Yeah.
Exactly. I don't know if I'll be that excited about it by then. I wonder if I'll be like, I can do it way better now.
You know, you have two kids. You'll probably have forgotten about it until you get like the sample in the mail. Like, oh yeah, I forgot that I did this.
I'll have to set a notification on my calendar. That's what's going to happen. And so those commissions are fun. It's hand lettering, which I enjoy. You know, what's funny about hand lettering is no matter how professional you get with it, I think you always feel like a novice because it's such a huge world. And you also see how other people do it. And as opposed to, say, painting, I don't know, a cruiser bike, which is also very popular.
I've noticed that.
Yep.
I've noticed a lot of cruiser bikes lately.
Especially if it has a basket in the front with flowers in it. With lettering, you see, oh, okay, well, that's a brush letter style. Mm-hmm. But man, they do it so differently. And you just can't help it, right? It's just part of your handwriting. So I think there's part of me that always feels like a novice with hand lettering. And you kind of want that too. So it's a neat tension. So So anyway, I've been doing those kinds of projects when it comes to commissions, because they already lay out the sayings, the things that need to be written.
Sure.
In a pretty way.
Sure. So with the stuff that you're building for licensing, when you're going through and finding those trends, you know, how are you deciding, or how are you keeping it fresh for yourself, mm-hmm. especially when you're like researching stuff of, you know, this is hot and trendy. So, you know, the marketing side of me knows this is gonna sell. How are you balancing that with finding kind of a passion behind something and a drive to want to do it?
Yeah, definitely. If I'm not excited about it, I'm not going to do it. Sure. Something that's really trending, for instance, is kind of abstracted brush blobs. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying?
I know exactly what you're talking about.
You're filling the whole page with blotches of color, and then there might
All over Creative Market, yes.
Yes. And there might be some really cool sassy saying on top, right? Mm-hmm. Hopefully in gold foil, because I fall for it too. I am not judging. This is so fun. But I haven't really gotten into that. You know, I'm not going to say it's not in my portfolio. You know, I'll look at it and I'll be like, huh, I wonder how I do that. And I look at it and I think, that wasn't that fun. I didn't really like that. So mm-hmm. For keeping it fresh, I think it's that monkey brain and that confusion. I don't know, not confusion, but desire to explore mm-hmm. that helps. Another thing is, we do think in seasons. So for an illustrator, the busiest seasons are, say, spring through summer and and then into fall. So summer, maybe one of those months is kind of dead as things kind of transition. But when you think of 6 months ahead to holidays, so companies either work 6 months ahead or a year and 6 months ahead, kind of typically. Then in the fall, we're thinking Easter, we're thinking, you know, spring florals, whatever, you know, you are kind of anticipating that. And then obviously in the summer, you're thinking of holiday and, autumn falls actually after Christmas, because Christmas is such a big deal as far as the market goes, that autumn is kind of the afterthought for Thanksgiving and Halloween stuff. But it's a huge market too. So that helps me. And then whenever I don't know what else to do, I'll do fashion illustration, which is not something I push in my portfolio. And it's not something I feel proficient at. But I think I just go back to being a little girl and wanting to, you know, paint pretty girls with cool clothes on. and I have fun with that. So I think if you scroll through my Instagram, you'll probably see, you know, the series, and then there's some, you know, hand lettering or faces thrown into there. And then there's fashion illustration. And then there's this. And then, you know, I'm noticing this rhythm that I have. I would love to paint like Bill Donovan.
Sure. With the stuff that, you know, is more commission-based and all that, do you ever find yourself wanting to branch out in styles or move into different genres, say like editorial stuff, or apparently that's the only one that I can think of at the moment.
Yeah, no, that's okay. And I feel the freedom to. The thing with changing styles or trying to veer in a different direction is then you've got to create another little body of work, at least so there's this kind of grouping. I think that it's not that the rest of the world is not creative enough or able to appreciate this one isolated piece that's so different from the rest. It's more like, I think we desire this context. And when you do an animal, let's say, and you never do animals, but then you do a handful of them, you get it in a way that you wouldn't in the way that when it's just one piece. It's kind of like the designer, going back to my design days, that walks into the meeting and it's like, bam, everybody be excited. This is my work. You should get it, right? Like you should talk through it. You should help people understand how you got there, why it's awesome. And that's,
I've worked with a few designers like that. Yeah. And I always just, I see them do that. And
Everybody's got this blank look on their face, right?
With the rare exception, I always cringe. There have been a few times where I've seen it and I get why they do it like that. Uh-huh. But for the most part, it's this, oh God, why would you do that?
And maybe it's that we all kind of want to be a part of it. For instance, if I paint something that I'm really excited about and I go, bam, yeah, people aren't as excited about it. But when they see me do it, or if they've seen a progression of, wow, you used to really stink at birds and these are coming out great, they almost feel like they're a part of it. Like they witnessed it. They can see a story, a narrative in it. And so, yeah, that's, I call it like the BAM designer. You can't, the listeners can't see me doing like a ta-da dance, but that's what I'm doing.
I definitely understand that. So something else you mentioned early on when we first started talking about the watercolor stuff, and I meant to get to it then, and then we got sidetracked on a tangent or something probably. Yeah, but yeah. You mentioned you do a lot of stuff with kind of like scripture studies for yourself. Mm-hmm. Walk me through that. How did that come about?
You know, when I was younger, I thought... I often wanted to paint as part of my quiet time, which is basically like a devotional time, a time of the day where I just like anyone would set aside time for something important. This is my time. I've wanted to paint, but then I think that's too much fun, or it would be distracting, or I would just get too obsessed with how this looks and not what I should be thinking about or really trying to soak in. And I found that it was just the opposite. When I had much less time, which I've progressively become more productive with my time, and I do attribute that to parenting in general. but yeah, when I had less
time. It's
easier
when they get older.
Yeah. And then I'll probably, you know, be like, productivity, who cares?
Well, I mean, my kids are only 1 year older than your oldest. So I'm just saying from like when they're a toddler to now.
Oh, sure. So when I had the baby, it was like, okay, I only have this amount of time. Maybe we could combine the two. Let's try that. And they both served the same purpose. It was both a calling back to this is who you are. And it was profound. And I found that, I could have fun with God. That's really great. Great. Mm-hmm. So I do still do some watercolor lettering of verses, but I've stopped mostly sharing them because I didn't know that this was a thing when I started out doing it.
And I didn't know it was a thing until you said that.
Oh, it is a thing. Yeah. And you can... by these cool Bibles that have like these massive margins for you to journal and paint in. But it's kind of an intimate thing. So I don't want to, pull the BAM on that.
Yeah. Keep it for yourself.
Yeah. And I do share
but
it
not necessarily
too.
In a selfish way, but in a, this is,
I do struggle
this is private
with that.
To me. Yeah.
Yeah, I struggle with that because some people don't feel a license to do it. And so you do also want to share. But when you share, you know, it's like oversharing. When you start sharing too much, you start to do it for the sharing and not for yourself. And so anyway, just for those who have followed me and are wondering, didn't you used to do this a lot more? It's just, I got to go back to what it means. So at church, I actually take my travel paints and my sketchbook and my water brush, and I'm always doodling. If I'm next to somebody, I'll ask them if it's okay because I don't want to be terribly distracting.
Sure.
But I kind of got it down. Take out the paint, squirt, okay, bring in an extra napkin, put it in my coffee cup that I was finishing on the way in, and we're up. I know how to time it just right to dry. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm assuming faith has kind of always been something that's been important to you and all that. Yes. How does that propel you through the art world?
I am on somewhat of a loose mission because it's not like my only mission in life, but I'm on kind of on a mission to prove that Christian art isn't cheesy. Like, you know, I want to show that, you know, it's all about being genuine. And so that's maybe also why I pulled away, because sometimes I'll look at something and it feels a little too commercial, mm-hmm. And not genuine, my own work and others. So, it does propel me. It, if you've ever read The Artist's Way, it's a book that came out in the early 80s, mm-hmm. Julia Cameron, and she's not necessarily coming at it from a Christian perspective, but she does talk about how we are all conduits of creativity and it being in you and it being something that just flows out. And so you need to nurture it by practicing it rather than sitting down and being like, okay, show up. And it doesn't work that way. So I really like her perspective. So yes, it does carry me on the days when I don't feel like I've got it and I'm just going to start doing whatever. And that's okay, because tomorrow the whatever will be something a little closer to awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And my poor family, they get so sick of me painting, I think, because I'll be painting at the kitchen table because I'm just doodling, or I'll paint for work and I'll paint for my faith and I'll paint when I'm just feeling something late at night. And I'm just, when we adopted our second. And so there, mm-hmm. are a lot of nights that I'm just in this room by myself, like just having the feels and painting whatever. Mm-hmm. Whether it's relevant or not. So
sure.
I like to see all those intertwine. The person, the faith, the craft. And I think that there's something really beautiful when all those do come together. And it's rare. But I think that's what we react to when, mm-hmm. we see a master do it, because it's flowing out of them more easily than someone, mm-hmm. who's struggling through it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we all struggle through things at a certain, mm-hmm. point, but mm-hmm. we all aspire to have something flow through us,
mm-hmm.
or hope to.
Yeah. For your pieces that are, you know, stuck in drawers to have a purpose, you know, they have a voice.
Yes. Yeah. I have probably several past garbage cans full of things that I probably should have kept.
Yeah. And there's, yeah. a lot of pieces that I have gessoed over, and I'm just like, I'm over this. It's almost like bad mojo to keep, mm-hmm. it. And we're going to make it something better next time around. Cause I can't look at this right now.
Sure. So do you find that since you are kind of constantly using, you know, you're doing painting for a profession, you're doing, mm-hmm. it, you know, for a hobby, you're doing it In almost every aspect of your life, do you ever find that you need a break from it?
Oh, yeah, for sure. But it's hard to tear me away from it. It's, sure. kind of like, I don't know, it's like being a bad drunk, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, but because it sounds like you use it to process things as well.
Yes, yes, I do. Yes. And so sometimes my father-in-law has a boat and we'll go out on the boat. I've learned to enjoy it. Honestly, I don't really love boating, but I've come to enjoy just stopping and taking an entire day to do something that I wouldn't take an entire day for, but, mm-hmm. it frees you up, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It unblocks maybe that go, 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 the gears, sure. that are always going.
Sure. Allows you to turn your brain off.
Mm-hmm. And I'm a notorious multitasker. And so
isn't
my
that
brain
just called
is
being a mom?
Yeah, my brain is fried by 5 o'clock, and,
sure.
my poor husband comes home and I'm on edge. And then after we eat, mom has wine and I'm all good again. Then I go be by myself, be my best self by myself. But yeah, it is consuming. But I don't think you have to put a leash on it. I think, you know, sooner or later you get sick and you have to stop.
Yeah.
Sooner or later, something happens.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it sounds very much like you have a real joy and a, a need to be able to process things that way.
Yeah.
So I admire and respect that.
Are you not there right now?
I am not there right now. I don't know why. It's just not it's not that I'm burned out. I'm just in a bit of a funk creatively. I mean, like I can still functionally do my job and come up with things that are creative, but finding self-motivating project and finding that motivation and stick-to-itiveness. That's hard for me. That's always been a challenge for me. This is the podcast itself is kind of the one exception to that.
So. Well, it's hard too, because I'll go through seasons where I'm not impressing myself, you know, I'm done with it and it's okay. Someone might like it. Maybe it'll sell, but I don't love it. And that's hard, but you go through those waves enough to know I just need to keep kind of plugging forward in some way. It doesn't have to be full scale and it'll come back.
Sure.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. Well, I think that's a good place to start wrapping stuff up. real quickly, do you have anything coming down the pike that you're excited about that aside from a calendar in 2019?
Yeah, something a little sooner.
Yeah.
I will be finishing the second of my lettering series, watercolor lettering on Skillshare. The first class was serifs, just because I'm smitten by serifs. And so this one is sans serif, or I'm just calling it block lettering for, you know, all the newbies to be comfortable with that wording. But it is that class that I'm learning to outsource through. So it's taken a long time. So I'm mostly excited to see it. Like, go out and be free. other than that, the birds that I was talking about, I'm excited that I'll be putting them together in a book. And the paint company that I use, Dr. P.H. Martin's, will be selling them.
That's awesome.
In their stores, or in their online stores. So,
that's awesome.
Yeah.
So speaking of the bird things, and you may know this, but... you know, because you were talking about how that kind of started off as a color study thing and then you got bored with the color study and went to the birds. Did you know that the kind of predecessor to Pantone was I just forgot what a bird ornithologist
I didn't know
of bird. Yeah, I saw an article about it. I don't know. It's probably been a year and a half or so ago.
Oh, funny.
Yeah, that's what the color swatches were based off of originally, was he was just painting color swatches of birds to get stuff ready for illustrations. And then that started the Pantone colors.
Wow, that's crazy. I didn't know about that. It's wild.
And someone's probably going to correct me and tell me I've got like half of those facts wrong. But I do remember bits and pieces of it.
Thanks for a great story.
Yes.
Cool.
Wow. So where can people find you online?
So going back to how I started painting again, my website is called Watercolor Devo, because that's basically what I'd call my paintings after those little nap time sessions. Mm-hmm. Like, I did a Watercolor Devo today. And although I'm not necessarily devoted to only watercolor, maybe someday that'll need some reworking. For now, that's right. So watercolordevo.com, and then on Instagram, same handle, Twitter, same, Dribble, et cetera, et cetera. So, and on Skillshare, you know, Amaryllis is a little hard to spell. It's the name of a flower spelt in Spanish and misspelt. Mm-hmm. So that can be confusing.
Wait.
Amaryllis spelt in Spanish and misspelt.
Yeah, I got that. So we talked about you're Puerto Rican. So your parents named you Amaryllis for the Spanish flower. But did they intentionally misspell it, or was this an accidental misspelling?
It was the nurse.
Oh, and your parents never corrected it?
No.
You need to have a talk with your mom there.
I know. So she actually wanted to have the English spelling. But in Spanish, it would sound like amarillis, because of that double L.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, all this talking about my name, I should probably spell it out, Amarillis.
and we'll link to all this in the show notes too. Yeah.
So on Skillshare, if you just look up watercolor, you'll probably see my face somewhere, I think.
Gotcha. I did not realize when I looked at it that it was misspelled.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It makes for a great domain name.
Yeah. So. Pretty easy to find when it's misspelled.
Google it. Yeah. So. Google it. You'll find me.
Awesome. Well, Amaryllis, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me tonight.
Thanks, Jason.
I really appreciate it. Yeah, I had a lot of fun. And go out and hug some necks.
All right.
You can find out more about Amaryllis on Twitter at WatercolorDevo, and be sure to check out the links in the show notes for more ways to keep up with her. You can keep up with the podcast on Twitter and Facebook at CreativeSOPod, and follow Creative South on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at CreativeSouthGA, over at CreativeSouth.com, and I'm at Jay Frostholm on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram. Visit JackPrints.com and get 20% off orders over $25 when you use promo code CreateSouth17 at checkout.
For a limited time, new Skillshare customers can get their first 3 months for just 99 cents to get unlimited access to thousands of classes when you sign up at Skillshare.com using promo code CreativeSouth. What are you waiting for? Start learning today. And remember, if you like the show, help support us over at Patreon.com/CreativeSouth. And if you like the Creative South podcast, head over to iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. Rate us and leave a review. This helps more people find the podcast and allows us to keep getting awesome guests. Now go out and hug some necks.